This episode of the Airplane Geeks podcast is brought to you by ComAvia, delivering leading-edge media to the aviation industry. ComAvia, the company the aviation industry turns to for the best in new media marketing communications. Visit them at commmavia.com. Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 333 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight, and with me is aviation historian David Vanderhoof from the What Just Flew By blog. Hi, David.
Hey, Max. Good to be here. Sorry I had to ditch a little early last week, but we're going to make it through tonight and looking forward to having a lovely conversation with our guest.
Yeah, absolutely. And besides our guest, who we'll introduce in just a second, we also have joining us Benay Wilson, the aviationqueen.com.
Yay!
And co-editor-in-chief at airwaysnews.com. Hey, Benay.
All hail the queen.
Nice to have you back on the show.
Glad to be here as always, gentlemen.
And I just want to publicly thank you, Benay, for agreeing to join us this episode a small 20 minutes ago.
Come on. Saving our ass for tonight.
That's right. That's right. And the reason that's the case is that Rob Mark, our aviation journalist from the Jetwine blog, is in transit. And I'm not sure if he's in flight or at an airport, but we don't think he'll be able to join us. Brian Coleman is similarly traveling or away or something like that. And so he's off as well. But
don't forget, Max Trescott is teaching someone to fly, which he found out at the last minute. So
that's right. So nothing stops us from bringing you this episode. And that's because we have a great guest this time. This is Dennis Hazel. Now, Dennis is the manager of customer service for the Metropolitan Washington Airports Authority. And he supports the terminal and airfield operations. And he also focuses on sort of the overall customer service experience at Washington Dulles International Airport. Now, before Dennis joined the Airports Authority, and that was back in June 2007, Dennis spent 23 years with American Airlines. He began actually as a flight attendant. He accepted management positions in Dallas-Fort Worth, Tulsa, Albany, Richmond, and Washington Dulles, where he spent the last 10 years as general manager. So, Dennis, welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast.
Well, thank you very much. And with an introduction like that, I was beginning to wonder if that was truly me.
Who is that guy, right?
Who is that guy?
Well, Dennis, when we talk about customer service in your role, I'm wondering, who is the customer? Is it the airlines? Is it the flying public? Who do you consider to be your customer?
You know, Max, that's a great question. And I will say that in the 7.5 years that I've been with the Airports Authority here in Washington, that definition has changed several times. And it continues to evolve as we begin to identify which services the airlines are going to offer and which services the airports are going to begin to offer. So if I had to narrow it down, I'd say everyone that comes into our airports is our customer. Whether you're a meter or a greeter, meaning you're dropping off someone, you're actually a customer and you're going out on a flight, or if you're an employee of the airport, as there are lots of things, as you well know, that we need to attend to get an employee to actually become a badge at the airport and function for that service company or that airline that they're working for. So we try to encompass and focus on everyone that comes into the airport.
All right, great. We're looking forward to talking more about that coming up with Dennis. Before we do that, though, we've got some aviation news to talk about, including the TSA has reacted to that gun running operation that we spoke about at airports. One of their own gets arrested for carrying a loaded gun. That's not supposed to happen. We'll also talk about some quirks in the FAA NPRM process and how that's impacting sims for training. Also, what's on the new NTSB most wanted list? And also new routes that can lead to lower fares. And then, David, you're starting something new this episode, aren't you?
That's right, folks. The Airplane Geeks now has an official in-flight movie of the month, I'm going to call this segment. And I'm going to do my first movie review of Steven Spielberg's Always.
We also have an Australia desk, more Qantas 767s flying to the Alice Springs Boneyard. Also, refurbished ex-Australian Sea Sprites start arriving for service in New Zealand. And the guys tell us that CASA may not be able to regulate some drones. David, I'm looking forward to that. Seems like we can't go by a week without talking drones.
I was going to say, didn't we start a show so we didn't have to talk about that subject?
No, we tried to separate it out, but there's too much bleed over.
Well, I guess so.
Also, aviation in Antarctica. Juan Fernandez brings us his fourth installment from McMurdo Bay. And then we have some listener feedback, a number of listener recordings that we have for you. We'll try and present as many of those as we can fit into this episode. So let's get started right away with the aviation news. Are you guys ready?
Ready.
I'm ready.
You bet.
First item comes from ABC News. This is TSA considering new security measures for airport workers. Now, we talked about the gun smuggling operation in a previous episode. I think at the time we said that two folks had been arrested. Now that's five arrests. And the Department of Homeland Security has announced some additional security measures. They're looking at enhanced screening for airline employees, some random security checks, and more patrols in secure areas by the TSA and by law enforcement. This was kind of a fast response, I think. I think the circumstances warranted it. Binet, do you think this is a fast response?
Max, it is so good that you called me for the show tonight because, as you know, at Aviation Daily and Aviation Week, I covered airports and security for almost 6 years.
Yes.
And back in March of 2007, there was a big hue and cry because there was a ring of baggage handlers in Orlando smuggling drugs and guns from the Orlando to Puerto Rico route that was flown by Calm Air. And I remember going to the National Press Club, and ACI North America was there, AAAE and TSA, and they were all, and there was somebody from the airlines too, and they were all sitting there going, "Oh, we're going to fix this. You know, it's just, you know, it shouldn't have happened." And I will say that they did start doing, because I worked for Delta too, so I had a CIDA badge at one time, and there was no security. You just went through. Mm. But they started doing random security checks, and there was a call to have checks done for all airline workers, but it was considered unwieldy. I think Miami Airport at the time was the only airport that did security checks on all airline employees. And I think it just kind of slid by the wayside. And so it's just interesting to me that now this is popping up another 5, 6, 7 years later.
Dennis, there are an awful lot of folks at the airport that are employees, folks other than the passengers coming and going. And I guess the big issue here is the security of those folks and screening them and making sure that there's no, you know, bad elements in that population. Is this something that's, you know, of concern to airports, do you think?
Well, you know, I think that in today's environment, all security concerns are definitely a concern of the airport. whether it's born here in our country or around the world, something that we have to focus on is always the security and the safety of our customers, our facilities, and obviously the aircraft and its customers.
Now, one of the interesting things also in this article is that it mentions that the Aviation Security Advisory Committee has been asked to look into airport security. This is a part of the, well, I guess the TSA that I hadn't been familiar with. We'll have a link in the show notes to the webpage that kind of describes these. But they state that the mission of this committee, this Aviation Security Advisory Committee, is to examine areas of civil aviation security with the aim of developing recommendations for the improvement of civil aviation security methods, equipment, and procedures. And the committee is made up of 21 individuals from a real wide variety of organizations. It's kind of the, you know, the who's who of the alphabet soup. There's Aerospace Industries Association, AIA is represented, CAPA, the Coalition of Airline Pilots Association, the Regional Airline Association, American Association of Airport Executives, the NBAA, AOPA, National Air Transit. It just goes on and on and on. It's kind of a quite a cross section. Have you guys been aware of this committee before, or in how it operated?
Well, I will say that there's always been a lot of support regarding aviation policy through our industry trade groups. You mentioned AAAE, AAAE. There's also Airport Council International, who are vigorous supporters of aviation policy and procedures, and who are very active working with federal government agencies in making sure that our policies and procedures are as robust as they possibly can be.
And so do individual airports get involved in that process, or is it really through the trade organizations?
Well, the trade organizations have a great relationship with the airports, and oftentimes what they'll do, Max, is they'll reach down to the airports to ask for opinions, comments on any sort of those proposed rulemaking or just any policies that they think may move forward for action. So some airports are certainly more involved than others, but it's with the over-encompassing feeling that those airports, if you will kind of be spokes models for the rest of the airports in the country.
Now, we have an item here. This comes from WSB-TV in Atlanta, Georgia. This is titled, TSA Inspector Had 22 Caliber Revolver in Carry-On Bag. This is kind of embarrassing, I guess, especially considering the timing, but apparently an FAA aviation safety inspector was passing through a security checkpoint at New York's LaGuardia Airport. This is after he arrived from Atlanta. And this loaded gun was discovered in his carry-on bag, and he was arrested as a result of that. It's interesting that this didn't get picked up at Atlanta where he boarded this flight.
Well, it probably didn't get picked up because he had a CIDA badge. And he went in Hartsfield. There was this little area where people went through. They called it the cheese grater because it kind of looked like that. The metal spikes, where you push and you kind of go through.
Oh, sure. Yes.
And if he didn't get the random search, then, yeah, it's entirely possible that he walked through and didn't have any inspection. And it's also possible he could have forgotten the gun. But if I didn't have people like this, I wouldn't have my Friday Strange But True Aviation News column.
That's right.
And it just amazes me because it just all the time. Oh, yes, this is a loaded gun. I forgot it was in my bag.
I know. David, how many times have we heard that in the last few years? It just seems like it's the constant thing.
Well, evidently, if you look at the TSA this week grabs, I mean, it's I just don't get it. I mean, firearm owners are very proud of the fact that they keep their firearms safe And God forbid, this guy was an FAA safety inspector.
I know, huh?
So what, I mean, I don't know. It just gets me, I'm like, Binet, it's sort of, you scratch your head and go, what on earth were they thinking?
And Dennis, this must be consistent with your experience at Dulles.
Well, you know, I hadn't heard of this story, Max, until you just mentioned it. But I will say that our TSA screeners locally, as well as those across the other airports here in this country, are challenged every day. And I think they do a fabulous job of catching firearms and a number of prohibited items. And in fact, if you follow TSA on social media, I mean, they're very, very good and very, very open about telling folks, hey, you know, this is what we found this week. We found, X number of guns or knives and those things that are prohibited items. And they're very, very good about telling folks, don't break. Forget about it.
Dennis is right. I read that blog every week because I get some of my fodder. Every week I highlight some of the things that screeners have found across the country. And we're not talking just about loaded guns. We're talking about tasers. We're talking about brass knuckles. We're talking about canes with swords hidden in them. I mean, and I agree with Dennis. They do an amazing job considering, you know, how many people are out there going through their checkpoints, especially at the busier airports. So, and I applaud TSA for being so open about the things that they are finding at checkpoints.
And they get a standing ovation from me as well. Mm-hmm.
But I still wonder what else gets through. I realize that this FAA inspector had authority to go places where the general public doesn't, but how many other people have inadvertently, I put that in air quotes because I don't know how these people do this inadvertently, especially this guy said it was his wife's gun and he forgot he had it. Your wife hands you a gun and you forget that you pack it? And literally, he packed it. So as much as I admire the TSA for everything they do, it just makes me curious what does get through.
Well, I don't know if they can be exactly blamed for this one because, you know, the rules
I agree.
Yeah. And you're right. You know, my sister is a cop and she has this gigantic 8-foot safe, gun safe in her house. And all of her guns are in there and accounted for. And, you know, when I tell her about some of these things, she's like, you know, you're supposed to just keep your gun in your safe or in a lockbox. Why was his wife's gun in a bag that he happened to pack and carry? I mean, it just boggles the mind.
Wow.
It's not his wife's lipstick or maybe her travel bag. It's a firearm.
I was just going to say, I think these are just reminders of how vigilant that we need to remain when we're at the airports, whether you're a customer flying out or whether you work at the airport. We all have a responsibility to ensure the safety and security of our airports.
And I don't know how much more the TSA could do in terms of communicating to the flying public, you know, what's not allowable. I mean,
but Max, this isn't the flying public.
Well, in this case,
this
it wasn't.
This is a flying administrator. I mean, this guy deals with the Federal Aviation, which really makes my skin crawl because they should know better.
They should.
Exactly.
All right. Well, speaking of the FAA, we have an item from AvWeb. This is instrument SIM rule rescinded. Now, this is concerning an FAA ruling that was issued, a final rule that was issued on December 3rd, and that allowed up to 20 hours on an approved simulator for instrument training. Before that, it was up to 10 hours, so this rule extended that. And now the FAA is withdrawing the rule. Now, this is kind of interesting. I didn't realize that this could happen, but normally, well, this part I knew, this part I think we all know, is normally new rules are established through this Notice of Proposed Rulemaking process, the NPRM.
And if you don't know that, listen to UAV Digest every week and we'll drum it into you.
Right, because we're waiting for the NPRM on the small unmanned aircraft. The FAA issues the NPRM, then the public has a comment period which is often 90 days, but the length of the comment period is up to the FAA. But then after the public input, the FAA could then modify their proposal before issuing the final rule. Well, it turns out that sometimes the FAA will issue the final rule before issuing the NPRM and having the public comment period, which is great, except that if anyone, and I guess that's the way it works, if anyone has an objection, then the rule has to be rescinded. And in this case, on the with respect to the flight simulators, two people objected. So the rule's out and reverts back. I don't know. David, have you ever heard of this this kind of a situation where the rule came first and the NPRM came second?
No. You know, anything's possible. But I'm pretty sure that there's a standard procedure, and I don't know why they would issue a final rule without the notice of proposed rulemaking. And two people complained. The one said flight simulators don't give a realistic environment, and the other one thought the rule gave simulators too much time credit. Well, I don't know. I could
see a situation where if the issue required some kind of immediate action, right, that it was a question of safety or that kind of thing, that the FAA could implement a final ruling, quote unquote, right away. This doesn't sound like that. It was that kind of a situation.
But they immediately changed the rule back once two people complained. So they're quite good at doing immediacy, but it's sort of like, I don't know. This is one of those ones that we could give to the FAA, and I don't think they'll ever give us a good answer. Let's just hope it doesn't, for the small UAVs, doesn't work out this way, because that could be really scary.
Yes, that would be. Well, of course, you'd have a lot of objections kind of instantly, I'm sure, no matter what the NPRM ends up looking like for small UAVs.
And it just seems like the needs of the two outweighed the needs of the many in this case.
Ooh, Star Trek reference.
Thank you. Thank you. I'm here all week. But yeah, and it boggles the mind too, because, you know, I think David said, you know, the FAA kind of, I don't want to say rushed this, but kind of pushed this through. And they're not known for being speedy on this sort of stuff. Mm. So it's just kind of interesting from that angle too.
All right, let's push ahead a little bit to the NTSB's 2015 Most Wanted list. We talked about the Most Wanted list previously when we had the NTSB on the show. And again, each year they publish this list, in this case 10 items, sort of advocacy priorities, let's say, for the NTSB. And, of course, the NTSB covers transportation of, you know, a variety of forms, not just air transportation. So you have items in here like sort of a general end substance impairment in transportation. That's one of them. I think they implement positive train control in 2015. I don't know what that means, but it's about trains, so that's for someone else's show. But
and it's positive, too.
And it's positive. That's right. We'll have to get Steve Fisher to tell us maybe something about positive train control. But aviation items: enhance public helicopter safety, prevent loss of control in flight in general aviation, require medical fitness for duty. I think that spans a couple of modes, but includes aviation. And same for strengthen procedural compliance. So it's a great list. We'll put links to that in the show notes. They drill down into each of them. So, for example, in the loss of control for general aviation, they answer the question, so what's the issue here? And it says, while airline accidents have become relatively rare in the U.S., pilots and passengers involved in general aviation operations still die at alarming rates every year due to loss of aircraft control by the pilot. So I think this is a good list of items that should receive priority, especially that one. General aviation safety is something that's kind of been around for kind of a while.
We should leave that for Jetwine to comment, since that's his big passion.
That's right. I'm sure we'll get some input from Rob on that. So anyway, the list will be in the show notes, or a link to the list. Invite you to take a look at those. And then we'll close off the news segment with an item from Airfare Watchdog. New routes can lead to lower fares. Route expansions, okay, it says in this piece, that's not always, you know, so exciting, but when people are extending their routes, that it can have some interesting consequences, especially for competition. So, for example, All Nippon Airways, ANA, this is one of them in this list, they are actually joining United in flying nonstop from Texas to Tokyo. That's starting on June 12th. ANA has 10 North American destinations now, and they're looking to connect Houston to Central and South America. So that has interesting competitive implications. There are some other examples. Daily service under the American Airlines British Airways code share. This is connecting New York City to Birmingham, England on American. There's also some additional pressures on other airlines.
But the one that caught me was, and it just doesn't look right, is Houston to Aruba on Southwest.
Aruba.
A non-U.S. destination in the word Southwest is just, it's going to take a while to get. Likewise, Baltimore, Washington, D.C. to San Jose and Costa Rica. It's just going to take a while to get used to Southwest doing international flights.
Dennis, when an airline is looking to expand or change its route structure like this, sometimes the availability of slots at airports must be of concern.
Well, that's only the case, though, when you're really when you're at an airport that has slot control. In reality, Max, many of the airports here in the U.S. are not slot controlled, so the airlines can come and go as they wish. For example, Washington Dulles is not slot controlled, and airlines can come and go as they please. However, over at our sister airport, Reagan National Airport, they are slot control, and then the airlines would not be able to land and take off as they so choose. They would have to give permission to do so.
So in an airport like Dulles that's not slot controlled, how is that managed? I mean, you have to have the gates available at the times necessary. So how does all that coordination occur?
Very carefully. I will tell you that when we learned late last year that Aer Lingus will be returning to Dulles, as well as Alaskan Airlines, and as you know, a lot of aircraft like to arrive and depart in what we call a peak, and oftentimes at the peak there is no room at the inn, so you have to become creative at where you park the airplanes, and in some ways, we have to suggest to airlines when they might be able to arrive and depart without any structural issues at the airport in terms of parking or gating that aircraft. So we always look for combinations of things when we think we have a gate available and try to fit that airline in at that time. Now, obviously, if they come outside of the peak, there's plenty of gate parking space. There's plenty of room inside our federal inspection stations if it's an international flight. And obviously, the mobile lounge service. So it's a very, very coordinated event with that air carrier. But we welcome any and all airlines that choose to fly to Washington Dulles.
So do you have specialists, airport employees who are specialists in this kind of area, or is it part of a larger job function?
Well, actually, it's our business administration office. And yes, indeed, they are kind of like specialists in dealing with this. Once they work with the airline representatives on when they want to fly, now typically, Max, the airlines know when they want to drop the airplane in, as their schedules are set. And fortunately, I would say a large percentage of the time, it works. But when you get into that peak, that between at 3 o'clock and 5 o'clock in the afternoon hour, where our gates are mostly full, it does take a creative mind and kind of like a Ouija board in order to get those airplanes in and get those airplanes out. But we make it happen.
Again, we're speaking with Dennis Hazel, the manager of customer service for the Metropolitan Washington Airports Authority. Dennis, from your standpoint, or from you personally, that means Dulles Airport, is that right?
That is correct.
And so, just very basically, we hear this term, you know, an airport authority all the time. Maybe for some of our listeners who may not be familiar with that terminology, what is an airport authority? Who makes them and what do they do?
Well, in our particular case, the Airports Authority was established in 1987. It was transferred to an independent authority under a 50-year lease back in 1986, and then the new legislation was signed in 1987. The Airports Authority here in Washington operates a two-system airport that provides domestic service at our sister airport at Washington Ronald Reagan National Airport. And then, of course, Washington Dulles can handle both domestic and international air service. The Airports Authority here is an independent organization that it's not taxpayer-funded, but it is self-supporting, meaning we use aircraft landing fees, terminal rents, and revenue from concessions, including our parking, which is our largest concession, to fund our operating expenses.
How big an organization is it? How many people are employed by the authority?
We're just hovering around 1,500 employees now.
Wow.
At work at the Metropolitan Washington Airport Authority.
And so that must include kind of a variety of different functions, right? Office functions and ramp functions and everything in between. Is that correct?
That is correct, Max. And, you know, I often, when I conduct tours or do an educational talk with others, with special groups, I often refer to the airport as a small city. Any function that you can think of that you have in a small city, you have at an airport. So we have our own legal department. We have our own law enforcement. We have our own public safety. We have our own engineers. We have our own planners. And we have our own plumbers and pipe fitters and all the people that keep the lights on in the place, as well as all the administrative folks that are responsible for long-range planning and even crisis planning.
And as the customer service manager, can you give us a little flavor for what your job is like?
You know, I probably have the best job on the planet, and I'm not saying that just to say it, because it really does allow me to connect with the heart of our business, and that's with the employees and our customers that choose to serve and fly out of Dulles International. So some of the things, though, that we try to do is to make that journey through our airport, from roadway to runway, a very seamless journey. And that's not always easily done. As you know, it takes quite a bit to get one airplane off the ground every single day. It's the same thing that happens at an airport, where you have multiple functions that need to come together to get that customer from the roadway to the runway. And fortunately, we do it well, quite well, on a daily basis, although there are times where we make mistakes. And that's when I really get a chance to kind of connect with the customer.
Do you think that the customers separate kind of what's under the purview of the airlines versus that of the airport? So in other words, when the flying public comes through and has an experience that's positive or negative, either way, I imagine they can direct that at the security, the TSA. They can direct that at the airlines or at the airport itself. Do you think people have a kind of good grasp, the average person, a good grasp of who's responsible for providing, you know, what aspects of the experience?
That's actually another great question. And I will tell you that I do believe the average person does have a grasp as to who's responsible for what in an airport. But that being said, there are a number of customers who confuse who's responsible for what. And it's not my job to necessarily educate them to, you know, who's responsible for what particular function. What I try to do as the customer service manager is to resolve the issue. Because to a customer, they're not really concerned about who's responsible. All they know is that they pay for a service in advance, most of the time. They pay for a service that they're not necessarily getting. And they just want the situation resolved. I'll give you a case study here. Just this past week, we had a customer who was flying from Johannesburg, South Africa, to London Heathrow, and then on to Dallas. Well, in London Heathrow, the airline that was supposed to take him from the United Kingdom to the States had a cancellation, and they placed him on another airline. Well, unfortunately, the reason why the customer came to my office is because it was day three and he didn't have his luggage. Now, most people know that the airport's authority, or the people that run the airport, really have nothing to do with the luggage. But the customer needed our help. Now, I could have easily said, you can go back to the airline in which you flew, or let me see if I can make that connection for you. And fortunately, we were able to locate his bag within 2 days. And the great end of the story is he just got his luggage. The airline did a great job of taking care of him in terms of allowing him some expenditures so he can have some clothes and some toiletries. But in this particular case, the customer knew that the airline lost his bag or misplaced his bag. They didn't lose it. They just didn't send it forward. But they needed to come to the airport, they felt, to say, hey, listen, I need your help. And that's what we did.
You know, Dennis, I think I just figured out what you meant when you said that you have the best job in the world, because it sounds, in order to do your job well, you have to know a wide variety of organizations, right? All of the actors, the players, you know, in this, you know, as you characterize it, this little city, what they do. And so that when there's an issue or when a customer needs something that they don't have, you know who to talk to, where to go, who can do something, who can find out, you know, more information or whatever. So you must have this really expansive network that you deal with all the time.
I do. And I will have to say, Max, that the professionals that I network with are extremely, extremely cordial. And very effective at helping me and really helping the airport itself maintain its image of providing consistent customer service.
I have to say, I'm sorry, Max, that Dennis is being very, very modest here. When I was at the British Airways A380 event out at Dulles, we were there for a good chunk of the day. And, I mean, walking around with Dennis is like walking around with a rock star. People were coming up to him. They were talking to him, saying hello, any type of issue. I mean, people would just walk up and have issues. And he's in the middle of this very big event because he had two groups. He had the media and he had the plane spotters, the ass geeks. And, you know, he was also dealing with the British Airways people, too. You know, so Dennis is just juggling all of these balls with cool, calm grace and a smile on his face. So he is really being modest here.
Well, you are way too kind, Adam. I tell you that, you know, and that's really just the passion that I have for people. You know, the one thing that I try to do and that I try to tell others when we go through our customer service workshops and other smaller sessions is to try to find a person that you can do something nice for every day. And you'll know, and this is what I tell them, that you'll know the difference between just doing something for someone and then doing something really nice for someone every day, because there's a different set of feelings that come up, different set of emotions that touch you. And you'll know what I mean. And it's equally very, very hard to do that, to seek out those customers that really and truly need your help. And with the 25,000 to 30,000 passengers we have going through our airport on a daily basis, you know, there are people out there that need our help, whether they're going to a funeral service or whether they're going to a graduation or a wedding, whatever it may be. there's an opportunity out there for us to make that experience extremely meaningful to them.
Dennis, is this an approach that you developed personally way, way back in the early days when you were a flight attendant?
Boy, I tell you, flight attendant was probably one of the best jobs I ever had at that, because it really set me on the it set me on course for identifying a skill set that I thought was important, and that's personal caring for others. That's making sure that those customers on that airplane. And see, now when I flew, we still had the 727s and the DC-10s, and it was an amazing time, the mid-1980s. We're flying. It required a lot. You know, we were on our feet and serving a lot and always in the cabin. But the one thing that the airline taught me, and I use this a lot as well, is called phase three. And phase three was a time as a flight attendant where you got to shine. And that was after you served all the drinks and served all the meals on the airplane and you picked up everything. You spent time in the cabin talking with your customers. And that's what I did on every flight. Not everybody fell asleep back then. And not everybody had earphones and you know, the noise-canceling headsets. But so there was a big opportunity to interact with customers, and that really made the difference. And that's why I really do love interacting with people. And thank you, Binet, for those kind remarks, because that just absolutely fuels the fire that, you know, what we do for the customer is extremely important.
And Dennis, I wanted to ask you, and I kind of touched on this a little, but, you know, I was so impressed with the program that you put together for the media, but also for the plane spotters, because there are a lot of airports out there. I'm not going to name any names, but Max should be familiar with one of them that are downright hostile to aviation geeks and the people who are enthusiastic about airports. And, you know, you guys have just embraced this population, and I mean, they love you right back. And, you know, we did a story on this, on you and what Miami Airport does to embrace the AvGeek population. So can you talk about that and how you guys decided to embrace rather than shun them?
Sure. The you know, it really started back in February of 2012 when we were looking for ways to celebrate Dulles' 50th anniversary. You know, for many years, Dulles sat out there and it was described as a white elephant, and people questioned about, you know, the viability of the airport. But, you know, 50 years later, we had a chance to celebrate something great. And so after speaking with several of my friends from other airports about a similar program that they had, I questioned our ability to do that here. But then I found out that the Space Shuttle Discovery was going to be arriving at Dulles. So I said, ooh, this is a great opportunity to invite the community. Because one of the key things that I think is important is to put the community, not the necessarily airport community, that too, but the community in which the airport resides, to connect them with what goes on at an airport. Extremely, extremely important. So I came up with an idea to invite 50 members of the community, because it was our 50th anniversary, to join us to watch the space shuttle land. And the way I built it was from a vantage point on the airfield, because I didn't know exactly how close I would be able to get the group of 50. So we ran a kind of a lottery through our website and had a huge, huge response. And as they say, the rest is history. The 50 plus individuals were extremely excited and got a chance to be out on the taxiway right next to where the space shuttle carrier aircraft and the Space Shuttle Discovery landed. And I have to really thank Margaret McKeel, who's our executive vice president and COO. She thought it was a great event. And she said, you know, Dennis, you need to keep doing this. I'm like, oh my gosh, can I recover from this event? And she says, you know, I think you need to keep doing this. This is a great thing. And we ought to call it Discover Dulles. So that's how it got started. And we've held a number of Discover Dulles events in particular during our 2012 year anniversary with the first ever 747-8 passenger flight from Frankfurt to Dulles on Lufthansa. We had the first 787 inaugural land here with Ethiopian Airlines. And we did an event for Iceland Air. We did an event for Air China most recently. And of course, Binet, as you know, we put on an event for the arrival of British Airways A380 here, which was a actually one of the most popular events that we've done.
Dennis, you also, for us Av geeks, you also have adjacent to your facility probably one of the greatest aviation museums in the world. What's it like working with the Smithsonian, like Ford Discovery's arrival and, of course, our Airplane Geek's favorite event at the Smithsonian, Be a Pilot Day?
Yeah, the fly-in on Father's Day, right?
Yep.
Yeah, that's a very popular event, and we're very fortunate to have just a great relationship with the Smithsonian staff. In fact, we're getting ready to put a nice display in our arrivals area, in our baggage claim area, that will talk about some of the neat displays at the Smithsonian and how to get there, because we do offer shuttle service from the terminal to the Smithsonian. But the people there are just professionals. You know, when you want to work with an organization that that exudes quality, consistency, and just the right attitude, you know, you can't look any further than you can at the fine folks at the Uparahazi Center and the Smithsonian in general. And we'll continue to look at ways we can partner with them to do fun events like the fly-in on Father's Day in June, or any other special events that they have. And as you know, when the museum was under construction, a lot of those aircraft were actually flown into Dulles, and it gave a chance for our many airport employees to see that, to see them land, and really just became a nice relationship with the great facility. And we're always looking for ways, and quite honestly, looking for ways to get the traveling public there faster and more efficiently.
Well, Dennis, I want to give you an opportunity to tell our listeners about the social media places where they can follow along or learn more. But first, I wanted to ask about opportunities, employment opportunities. You know, oftentimes folks listening to this who have an interest in aviation have the response like, wow, this sounds like a great place to work or a great kind of a profession. How do I get into that? Do you have any advice for those kinds of people?
I certainly do. In the Metropolitan Washington Airports Authority, and if I can rewind for just a moment, Max, you know, I came to Dulles in 1997 as the station manager for American Airlines, and just had a wonderful career at American, and was really, really torn at leaving. But if I had to leave, I said, you know, I'd only want to work at that airport, for the Metropolitan Washington Airports Authority. And just so happens, they were hiring for the position that I currently have today. And the only people that knew about it, that knew about me even thinking about leaving, was my wife and my secretary. That was it. I didn't even tell anybody at the Airports Authority that I was thinking about it, because I didn't think that would be right. But, you know, I went online, just like anybody else who's interested in joining the Airports Authority can do. So you go to MWAA.com, Metropolitan Washington Airports Authority.com, and right there in the blue band on the upper right-hand side, you're going to see something that says careers. And if you click on that, you're going to see that the jobs that we have available will be listed. And this is updated on a weekly basis. And so, like I did, others can do the same. And that's the first foot in the door. And as you know, with a two airport system, and now of course we have a toll road that connects the airport as well, and an access highway. You know, we have our own employees there as well. There's a lot of opportunity to come to work for us here at the Metropolitan Washington Airports Authority.
So we have MWAA.com, and how about other the social media places, Twitter and so forth?
Yeah. So we're not out there advertising on Twitter or or Facebook or Instagram, if you will, any of the career prospects. But that gives me an idea because you're talking to the guy that's probably 90% of the social media influence here at the Airports Authority, at least for Dulles. Hmm. But we are on, as you mentioned, we are on Twitter, we're on Facebook, and we're on Instagram. In fact, you can actually find us at at Dulles_Airport for Twitter and for Instagram.
Yeah, I think for Facebook, it's Washington Dulles, isn't it?
That's what it is. Thank you very much.
Sure. And we'll put links to all of these in the show notes, of course. All right. Well, great. Dennis, Hazel, we're really glad that you had an opportunity to join us for this episode. I want to thank you so much. We really appreciate all the great information.
Well, thank you very much. And it's really been a joy to work with you all, Max, David, and of course, the Queen.
Always.
I'm so glad that I was on this episode.
Thank you all for having me.
And here's David Vanderhoof with the inaugural Airplane Geeks In-Flight Movie of the Month. Take it away, David.
Thanks, Max. This was going to be a little awkward because I I'll be apologetic up front because I'm not really quite sure why I got my bearings on it, but we'll see. The Airplane Geeks In-Flight Movie for January 2015. Always. Sometimes you get a match between director and actor that just works. Richard Dreyfuss and Steven Spielberg are one such pair. Jaws and Close Encounters of the Third Kind are two really good movies. While filming Jaws, the pair decided they wanted to recreate a movie called A Guy Named Joe. That wartime movie would eventually become Always. In A Guy Named Joe, Spencer Tracy was a B-25 pilot in Europe in World War II. Pete would then become Richard Dreyfuss in Always and flies an A-26 Invader and bombs fires and not cities. So is it good? On this latest rewatch, I was taken about how much the movie is character-driven, and the aircraft are just part of the story and not the story. I have called this in the past a chick flick with airplanes, but cool airplanes. So let's start with the cold open. It's just great. A long shot of a peaceful lake with two guys fishing, and a PBY that scares the hell out of them. It cracks me up even to this day. So I was trying to figure out what an Airplane Geek's review of a movie is. So here's some of the criteria I came up with. How's the flying? Overall, excellent. The dead stick landing is completely convincing, and it's nice to see a movie with old school non-CGI effects. The aircraft are what they say they are. When Al is flying a Cessna 337 Skymaster, that is exactly what he calls it. Overall, they seem to have the details right. Now, Spielberg's father was in the Air Force, and Spielberg likes airplanes. During the drop school scenes, you actually get to see live drops. And John Goodman is very convincing as he calls the trainees into put out the flames. The movie also finds a balance between the jargon for the geeks and keeping it simple enough for the civilians. Shell watched the movie with me and laughed out loud during the runaway follow me tractor scene. To quote her, "That's way too funny." However, she thought the overall movie's premise was depressing and didn't like the fact that it made her cry. I, on the other hand, thought there's nothing prettier than the A-26 flying over the moonlit water, and it reminded me why I do love the A-26 Invader. Some other geeky things is what an airplane geek wouldn't want, like Dorinda's apartment with the skylight open to the final approach to an airport with good old fish Trijet or DC-10 flying in and good old American Airlines livery. What's not so good? Well, I'm not sure how believable the fire drop is that saves Al's life is. It's models, but it doesn't take away from the pure beauty of the heavy iron in the show. Most of the model scenes are quite convincing and do not distract from the movie. So, I still like it? Yes. I like watching the movie in its entirety and it seems to hold up. I don't feel the need for what I call the Top Gun fast forward, where we skip everything but the hops. So for Always, I'm going to give it 4 out of 5 props. It's a good movie you can geek out on and still have the family enjoy it with you. So for In-Flight Movie for February, I've selected 3 choices, and we're going to put them up to Facebook, and you guys get to pick it. The first one is Firebirds, with Nicolas Cage, and that movie is so bad it's good. Jet Pilot with John Wayne. There's nothing better than a Russian X1. Or sticking with the Brad Johnson theme, I thought, well, we did his first airplane movie. We might as well do his second, which was Flight of the Intruder. So with that, this is your newly minted airplane geek movie critic, David M. Vanderhoof, signing off.
All right. Good, David. I like this. This is fun.
I like this, too.
Yeah. So I like your prop rating. You know, as you were going through that, I'm thinking to myself, you know, there needs to be a rating system for this. We need to have, like, David's rating of the movie. So props works. I'm going to have to find a some kind of little graphic that we can put up on the show notes to go along with this, giving you a rating. So I'll have to find some good prop icons or something like that.
Like a 1 through 5?
Yeah, 4 out of 5 props, you know, and I kind of liked the, when I started thinking about it, it was sort of, it's got a little double entendre there, you know, props as in, you know, props to people. So we'll do props as a rule, and we'll have the next week or so for people to figure out what the movie's going to be for February, and then we'll all watch it. Now, I'm looking forward to hearing feedback on what other people thought of Always.
Very good. Yeah, send that to thegeeks at airplanegeeks.com. Give us, and also give us your rating. How many props do you think Always deserves? We'd love to see that.
The didgeridoo means it's time for the Australia News Desk. Here's two of the craziest guys we could find south of the equator. It's Steve Vischer and Grant McHaren from the Plane Crazy Down Under podcast.
Dateline, 19th of January, 2015.
Well, good day, folks, and welcome to the Australia Desk for episode 333. Well, geez, Grant, you look a bit tired. What have you been busy, mate?
Yeah, I've been a little busy at work, mate. Had my CASA panel interview and managed to pass that. So I'm now accepted to perform a lot of the maintenance management, things like that, for a few air operators. But I'm not the only one looking tired. I don't remember you getting up to CASA and all that kind of stuff. How come you're tired?
No, in fact, I was out living the high life yesterday with Max Flight's favourite Australian, the infrequent flyer himself, Anthony Simmons. And I think I may have drank a little bit too much red wine as well.
Hang on a second. Steve, you barely drink two light, you know, low alcohol beers. What are you doing drinking red wine?
It was free. I'm Dutch.
Oh, no wonder you got a hangover.
Yes. We were out at the Melbourne Cricket Ground yesterday in the Members Reserve, in the sporting capital of the universe. I tell you, it was wonderful.
Bloody. Oh, it's only the Melbourne Cricket Ground. I mean, the MCG. Jeez, come on, man.
All I can tell you is that Max's favourite Australian was absolutely in his element. It was a sight of wonder to watch. Anyway, Grant, a sight of wonder to watch Qantas 767s flying. You know, Grant, I thought they'd been retired. There's a few of them been flying around our skies from all these reports I see here in australianaviation.com.au.
Well, you'd be right there, mate. But remember, these are the de-identified Qantas ones. You know, they only have a big red tail. And you can just make out the faint outline of where there used to be a kangaroo. And all the Qantas logos are gone. And these are those repositioning flights that were going on last week. Well, they're still continuing. And another two 767s have flown out to Alice Springs to go and join their mate over in the graveyard.
Yeah, it's funny, Grant, looking at these pictures here, that kangaroo looks like a lot of other kangaroos I see up here on the highways. It looks like roadkill, but anyway.
Oh, well, as we reported a couple of weeks ago, Steve, the first of the ex-Qantas 767s wound up at the Alice Springs Boneyard, and another two have gone to join it, these two being VHOGM, Oscar Golf Mike, and Oscar Golf Uniform. So now a grand total of 3 red tails parked at Alice Springs.
Well, there's some interesting aircraft going into Alice Springs, Grant, but although the plane spotters might be interested to look at those now former Qantas aircraft, there's actually an Antonov 74 that's made an unscheduled stop at Alice Springs. And I'll tell you what, Grant, a very, very weird looking aircraft. And from all reports, it ain't going anywhere right in a hurry. Maybe they'll park it in the boneyard.
I hope not, mate, because it's a very funky aircraft. The Antonov 74-200, it's the one with the turbojet engine. Engines mounted on the shoulder of the wing. So they're actually above the wing, just near the wing root, which itself is mounted on the top of the fuselage. Not a huge aircraft by any stretch of the imagination, but apparently it was doing a cargo run and coming in on a diplomatic mission from Kuala Lumpur, landing in Broome and then heading on to Canberra. And on the way back from Canberra to Jakarta, it stopped off at Alice Springs. And unfortunately, went unserviceable. And the rumors, as per the comments on the page, that it's a bit of an engine problem and that a bucket of fuel drained from the engine looked like metallic paint. So it sounds like something may have fragged itself in there.
Yeah, or also the other comment that was there from Red Baron. I'm pretty sure I know who that is, actually. He says, ran out of vodka? He might be right.
He could very well be right.
Indeed.
But yeah, hopefully that aircraft does get repaired and head out, because we'd love to see it come back and get some more photos of it in the air.
Absolutely. Now, Grant, something else that's going to be getting into the air very shortly across the Tasman over in New Zealand. And here we go again. Another case of those pesky Kiwis making something work that we couldn't. Looks like some Super Sea Sprites that were originally going to be ours and now theirs.
Correct, mate. We've been reporting on this over the past few years. The Kiwis currently operate a set of five SH2G Sea Sprites, and they've been running them for a number of years. They were purchased new, they've been operated very heavily, and they're currently having reliability and availability issues due to the difficulty in getting spares for some of the onboard components and avionics and so on, and also just the general airframe life. So as we reported a while back, Australia sold 10 of their Super Sea Sprites onto New Zealand, and they've been taken back by Command. And they've been refurbished and they're going back out to New Zealand. So even though these airframes are actually older than the ones the Kiwis are currently operating, the refurbishment means that they're almost but not quite entirely zero timed, and they're available to fly out until 2030.
Yeah, that's interesting. Looking at this article here that we see in verticalmag.com's talking all about that. And I thought that was the most interesting thing, Grant, because the ones that the Australian government bought, which were refurbed 60s versions of US Navy aircraft, they could never make them work, if you remember from reports that we'd done a few years ago. And in 2008, that rather expensive program was cancelled, and they actually never flew, really, in operational service for the Royal Australian Navy. But the aircraft that are being replaced and on sold to Peru over there in the Royal New Zealand Navy, they're actually sort of 2001 to 2003 build aircraft. So as Grant said, a lot newer, but you know, the refurbed ones, well, virtually brand new anyway. So there you go.
The Aussies tried to make these Sea Sprites a two-person operation instead of three, as the Kiwis operate them. And unfortunately, there was massive problems with the software project, big delays, a number of hassles with flight control systems and trying to make everything work with only two crew. And the Aussies just eventually shut the whole project down due to massive overruns. Cayman took the aircraft back, continued to develop them a little, but also reverted them back to a three-person crew. And lo and behold, they work. So out of interest, Steve, the aircraft are actually operated by the Royal New Zealand Air Force on the Royal New Zealand Navy ships.
There you go. All right, no worries. Well, moving on, Grant, let's have a talk about drones. You know, those guys over there have that other podcast, UAV Digest, of course. And it's always interesting to hear about the challenges and legal challenges that you know, a lot of countries seem to be facing when it comes to this, and you know, how do we regulate these? Well, it turns out that the Civil Aviation Safety Authority, or CASA, everybody's favourite regulator in this part of the world, Grant, well, it looks like there might be a bit of a challenge going on. It may even be that it's unconstitutional for a lot of them to be regulated by CASA. Now, wouldn't that cause a bit of a stir in the halls of power?
Yeah, it would be rather interesting. UAS International Chairman Ron Bartsch, we've mentioned him a few times in the past. He's a bit of a legal boffin on aviation law, and he's considering that drones that have electronic fences, or G-gates as they're known, which is where the GPS prevents them actually going into areas such as within 5 nautical miles of an aerodrome or above 400 feet in a populated area, all these kind of things. If you've got a UAS or a UAV that cannot go into those areas because it's prevented, that means that they're not going to do what's called commingle. So they're not going to commingle with other interstate and international aircraft. And that means they're not really going into navigable airspace, which means they're not covered by CASA. This is all based on the laws and international obligations from the Chicago Convention. And it means basically that if you're operating a UAV that cannot go into those kind of areas, CASA can't do anything about you.
Yeah, now that, of course, doesn't mean that it mightn't violate some individual state laws. We might talk about that in a minute. There's another story there that's kind of interesting. But yeah, that's got to be an ongoing problem, I think, as this sort of technology becomes more and more commonplace. Are they going to have to change the laws? And if they do, will they have to change the Constitution here? That means all sorts of headaches, very expensive headaches. In fact, would it require a referendum? I don't really know. But certainly something to keep an eye on, and maybe the guys will cover that at some point in the UAV Digest. Not that we'd like to make work for you or anything, Max and David.
Oh, no. Despite a few people making work for CASA and the local police, as expected, a whole lot of drones were supplied in Christmas presents, and people are discovering the hard way that they shouldn't be flying them near aircraft, airports, above 400 feet, closer than 30 meters from people, vehicles, boats and buildings and all that kind of stuff. And so, of course, we've had a number of CASA warnings go out to people, and we've even had a Victorian man fined because he crashed his drone during a police operation in Altona near Melbourne. He was flying a recreational unmanned aerial vehicle and got an $850 Australian fine for flying his drone within 30 metres of people after the drone hit a power line and narrowly missed a police officer.
Oh, I think we're getting to the crux of it now. He narrowly missed the police officer. I think that might have been a very, very unhappy senior constable, don't you think, Grant?
Oh, I think it was probably a very unhappy operator. Oops.
Yeah, I tell you what, might have been a $50 drone and $850 fine. I tell you what, he'd be going back to Toys R Us as quick as he can, I reckon.
I'd say so. But once again, it's as the boys from UAV Digest have been saying, it's really great to see manufacturers putting those notices and boxes with that the drones come in. We need to see more of that. And I think that is going to start happening here in Australia if we're lucky.
And I should mention, Grant, that those last two articles were by our friend Steve Creedy in theaustralian.com.au. And remember how they used to pick on us for using Steve Creedy articles all the time, Grant?
Yeah, I remember. The good old days.
There you go. It's a bit of a flashback. Well, we could drone on and on and on, but we won't do that. It's almost as if I pre-planned to use that line. Until next week, I'm Steve Vischer.
And I'm the in-pain Grant McCarran.
Cheers, folks.
The agony. The agony. He used it.
Oh, yeah. I still got it after all these years.
There's a presumption there.
David, I don't know. Leave it to the guys down under in CASA to complicate the whole drone issue even more.
Yeah, I mean, we've got real issues here, and I don't know if it's going to get any better. And CASA seem to be on the right. You know, they seem to be getting their act together and making the FAA look bad, but sounds like they're about to get derailed.
Yeah, this sounds like murky kind of issues. If the drone is incapable of interacting with other aircraft, then saying that the regulatory agency doesn't have authority to regulate it, boy, that could get awfully messy. But hey, we want to thank Steve and Grant for the Australia Desk, as always, and for muddying the drone waters even more. All right, up now, even though Brian Coleman is not with us this episode, he did send along a recording. Recently, Brian visited the Aviation Hall of Fame and Museum in New Jersey. That's in Teterboro. And he brings us this short report.
During my absence from the Airplane Geeks, I had a few free minutes on a recent trip to New York, so I decided to check out the Aviation Hall of Fame in Teterboro, New Jersey. Yes, Teterboro isn't exactly close to New York, but it is close to Newark, and this little but growing museum is well worth your time. Having spent the first 21 years of my life in New Jersey, I never knew the Aviation Hall of Fame existed. Founded in 1972, it is dedicated to the preservation of the Garden State's distinguished contributions to air and space. The men and women who have made such great contributions to the field of aviation that we love so much are honored here. The recently expanded museum offers visitors an opportunity to view historic aircraft and space equipment and artifacts and photographs, fine art, and they also have an extensive model airplane collection. I especially enjoyed looking at the old aerial photographs of Newark and Teterboro airports. Oh, how these airports have changed since their first construction. You start your self-guided tour of the museum by watching a short video. I was amazed to learn about the deep and rich aviation history of New Jersey. From the days of first flight, through the tragedy of the Hindenburg disaster in Lakehurst, New Jersey, to the first woman who walked in space, New Jersey has been significantly involved, much more than I ever would have imagined. After the 7-minute video, you can walk around the 3 or 4 rooms that house their collection. Sure, this isn't the Smithsonian Institution's Air and Space Museum, but they do a great job with what they have. These rooms include such things as the first electronic flight simulator built by Curtiss Wright, at one time the largest aerospace company in New Jersey, exhibits on the Tuskegee Airmen, my favorite Flying Tigers, Barnstormers, the Enola Gay, aircraft and rocket engines that were all built in New Jersey. Exhibits also include actual fragments of the Hindenburg, the world's first hovercraft, hot air balloon to space exhibits. They really cover the long history and accomplishments of New Jerseyites. Although the on-site library was closed when I was there, it is more than 4,000 volumes and hundreds of aviation videos. I'm sure David would be able to spend days, if not weeks, there. Outside the building, there are a few aircraft and military vehicles on display. It was sad for me to see these pieces exposed to the elements, but I also understand the museum does not have the funds to house them in a hangar. At the very least, they are on display for all to enjoy. Back inside, there's a second floor room with a balcony that allows you to overlook their great room. From there, you get a bird's eye view of the collection below and a closer look at the exhibits that they have hung from the ceiling. This museum, like many, survive on the generous contributions of a few corporate sponsors and the very affordable entrance fees they collect. I definitely believe I got my $6 worth of value during my two-hour visit. So please, if you're in New Jersey, make a trip to the Aviation Hall of Fame in Teterboro and give them your support. It's well worth your time and money. If you're not in the area, please search for your local museum. You might be surprised to learn what's around you. Just like me, you might be shocked to see that you have a little gem in your own backyard. This is Brian Coleman, Associate Producer of the Airplane Geeks, with my quick review of the Aviation Hall of Fame in Teterboro, New Jersey.
Oh, thanks for that, Brian. Binet, have you ever been to this museum?
Yes, I have.
You have?
And it is, yes, I have. My one of my best friends from college lives in Rutherford, and I was trying to turn her kids into little aviation geeks, because we'd sit out in the backyard because she was on the final approach of Teterboro and Newark.
Hi.
And so we had a great view from the backyard, and one day I said, I heard there's a museum here, and we went, and it's just as wonderful as Brian said. That Hindenburg exhibit is amazing.
Wow. Yeah, I drive past Teterboro probably two or three or four times a year, not too far away from the museum. I'm going to have to stop sometime.
Definitely. And the price is, that's just a steal. I actually made a bigger donation because I felt like I hadn't paid enough.
Oh, wow. Well, that's there's a ringing endorsement. David, you must have visited this.
Oh, yeah. With family in North Jersey, I've been there. Yeah, but I haven't been there in a really, really long time. So it's probably I'm probably due back for another visit.
All right. Well, we'll have to do that, too. Okay. Now we have report number four from Juan Fernandez from McMurdo Bay in Antarctica. Here's Juan.
Hello, Geeks. This is Geeks on Ice reporter Juan Fernandez from McMurdo Station, Antarctica. Today, we're going to talk about air operations at William Fields, also known as Willy. We mentioned before that Willy is located on the Ross Ice Shelf, and this gives it a unique attribute. Willy is probably one of the few airfields that move with time. The ice shelf moves at an average rate of 1 foot per day on a westward direction. Willy has two skiways that are made of compacted snow. These skiways, taxiways, and ramps require constant maintenance. Special machinery is used to grade and compact the snow. Additionally, special forklifts with extra wide tires and sledges are used to move cargo around. Three types of aircrafts can be seen at Willy. The large LC-130s from the New York Air National Guard, the medium-sized turbine DC-3s, and a smaller De Havilland Canada Twin Otter. The LC-130 has keys that are the size of a compact car and a massive hydraulic system that can lift a fully loaded Hercules so that it can change between conventional wheel landing gear to the skis. This wheel ski system first flew in 1957 with the C-130 Model A. The first aircraft built specifically for Antarctica were not ready until 1960 based on the B model. The Hercules model for the current iteration of the LC-130 is Model H. The LC-130s are used for transport of personnel and cargo between McMurdo Station and other scientific stations such as the South Pole, the West Antarctic Ice Sheet Divide, Central Transantarctic Mountains Camp, and many other. This year, there are about 10 compact snow skiways in Antarctica that can support LC-130s. The LC-130s are also the only planes that fly between McMurdo and Christchurch, New Zealand, in the middle of the Austrian summer. The turbine DC-3s and Twin Otters are owned by Ken Borek Air of Calgary, Canada, and operated for the U.S. National Science Foundation. The Twin Otters on skis are perhaps the modern workhorse of Antarctic aviation. It is in essence a large twin-turbine bush plane with a capacity for 19 passengers or about 5,000 pounds of cargo, including fuel. It can be quickly configured for passengers, cargo, or both. Because of their short takeoff and landing capability, even from unprepared fields, the Twin Orders are used to deploy scientists and their equipment to remote deep fields of Antarctica. The Twin Orders have also been modified to carry scientific equipment to study the ice, snow, and the unique environment of Antarctica. However, the airplane that it's a little bit harder to spot here, and perhaps my dream airplane to someday fly with, is the Turbine DC-3. The Turbine DC-3 is called here a Basler, and to be fair, it should follow the designation BT-67 for the Basler conversion of the Douglas DC-3. I prefer the designation Turbine DC-3 because over the years there have been many turbine conversions of the DC-3. For me, the actual conversion does not matter. What astounds me is the versatile and robust design of the original DC-3 that allows for conversions in the first place. Another reason I prefer the Turbine DC-3 name, which is also why this might be my favorite plane around, is that through the different variants of the DC-3, it has the longest record of Antarctic service of all aircraft that have flown to and in this wide continent. Navy R4Ds have been present in Antarctica since Operation High Jump that took place in January 1947. Part of this operation consisted of 6 R4Ds with 6 PBM-5 Lion boats. The 2 aerial photos of 1.5 million square miles of the interior of Antarctica and about 5,500 miles of its coastline. However, the DC-3 greatest milestone came on October 31, 1956, when aviation and Antarctic exploration history was made when a R4D named Que Sera Sera, what will be, piloted by Lieutenant Commander Conrad Gus Shin and Captain Williams Hawk under the command of Rear Admiral George Dufek, made the first landing on the ice South Pole. The Que Sera Sera had 7 souls on board, and these were the first Americans to set foot on the geographic South Pole, a feat that had not been achieved since 1912. Today, the R4D Que Sera Sera is at display at the National Naval Aviation Museum in Pensacola, Florida. It still has its keys and its JATRO canister rack, but also today at Williams Field, its younger brother, a Turbine DC-3, Mike Kilo Bravo, stands guard on its keys, awaiting for the next set of passengers and cargo to arrive. To continue the long history of support of scientific exploration of Antarctica, perhaps not as glorious as Que Sera Sera, but definitely equally important. And with these notes on Antarctic aviation operations and history, this airplane geek on ice says, hasta pronto.
David, are you familiar with this turbo DC-3 conversion?
Yeah, you need to go to Oshkosh and you'll see them.
Do you really? Well, you know,
Basler actually is on the opposite side of does the conversions at Oshkosh. So you have basically you get a stretched, and they're not really DC-3s or C-47s, but they get turboprops with 5 bladed props. And the first time I actually saw a Basler converted C-47/DC-3. It's amazing what additional power does to a 1940s aircraft. It completely redoes the whole airplane, and they just don't build them like that anymore.
Yeah, the engines they put on these are Pratt & Whitney Canada, PT-6As, big turbo props. And like I say, that increases, according to the Basler website, increases the load capacity 43% over the piston DC-3. And of course, you mentioned it was stretch, right?
Yeah, there's an additional fuselage plug.
Yeah, that gives it a 35% increase in space. Interesting airplane. We'll put a link to that website in the show notes. And also, you can find the page that Juan has up at airplanegeeks.com/ice. Or redirect you to his webpage.
Every time I listen to that report, Juan does a better job than I do. I mean, I was gonna set myself up to say, you know, okay, well, you can find Case Arad's living at Pensacola, and he'd already covered it, you know, and he did an amazing job talking about the LC-130s, which is one of my favorite versions, you know, of that aircraft. So really great job, and Juan, I just. When I see your email pop up, it's the first thing I do. It's really cool that you've been doing these reports for us, and we're really lucky. Thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, we love listener recordings, and we've had one from Micah for quite a while, has been in the queue. And so we want to bring that to you this episode. This is from Micah. He calls this Undergraduate Air. So here's Micah.
Growing up, I assumed that my mom, Harriet, merely tolerated the passion my father and I had for airplanes. If you would have asked me as little as 10 years ago, I would have told you that I became an airplane geek through my father, and perhaps that's true. It was only in her later years that Harriet came out of the closet as an airplane geek, and that's when I realized that my inherited madness came from both parents. Let me tell you a bit about my dad, Lou. He was 6 feet tall and looked like a cross between actors Victor McLaughlin and Claude Rains. In fact, one time, while attending theater in New York City with Harriet, they were stalked by someone who insisted he was Claude Rains. No matter how much my dad would deny it, this obvious fan would not leave him alone until he gave the man an autograph as a classic actor. As a true raconteur, my dad could tell that story, among many others, very well. He could keep people of all ages entertained and maintain their interest for hours. Lou tuned in on me, his oldest son, being a naturally born airplane geek, probably before I was 5. Throughout my life, I was fortunate to be regaled with stories about the aircraft he had flown on or seen during his time in Europe as an Army draftee in World War II, and as a retread first lieutenant as a psychologist for the medical corps of the then newly formed Air Force during the Korean conflict. After Lou met Harriet and married in 1955, they flew all over the world together until he passed in 2008. It was only recently that I realized that I had only flown with my dad just a total of 4 times. One of those flights, however, was among one of my very favorites, and I think his too. Back when I was an undergraduate at Ohio University, the idea of a parents' weekend was not in fashion. There was a dad's weekend in the fall and a mom's weekend in the spring. Travel to Athens, Ohio from my folks' home in northern New Jersey was not an easy thing. It was a 650-mile drive, about 12 hours in total, or a flight to either Columbus, Ohio, 75 miles from Athens, or to Parkersburg, West Virginia, only 50 miles away, but just as distant in driving time. Being that I didn't have a car, if and when my folks would fly out to visit, I had to scrounge around for a ride to get them from the airport. For my senior year, I invited Lou out for my last dad's weekend as an undergraduate. He was able to make it, and it turned out, scheduling-wise, that it was easier for him to fly to Parkersburg. I now had to figure out how to get him to Athens. For some reason, finding a ride was more difficult this time than in the past. It was a Tuesday before his Friday arrival, and I was still without a plan. I was growing desperate and started going for radical ideas. Now, a distant friend of mine since freshman year, Bondo, was in one of my classes this semester. Yes, we called him Bondo. In fact, I never even knew his real name until he happened to be in this class with me. Bondo was enrolled in Ohio University's avionics program and had his PPL. Being desperate for a ride, I asked him how he was doing on building hours and if he would want to fly from the OU airport to PKB to pick up my dad. Bondo thought it was a great idea and said he would reserve a plane and get back to me with the details. I offered to split the cost with him, but he declined, saying he needed the hours anyway and would just be changing his flight schedule rather than adding to it. This was great. I was all set, and I knew it would be a great treat for Lou and decided to make it a surprise. On Friday, Bondo arrived in his pickup, and we drove the 10 miles to the Ohio University Airport in Albany. It was a cool November day at about 4 p.m. As we were signing out the Cessna 172, Bondo's instructor came by and reminded him that he was not current on his night flying. At that time, I didn't know what this meant, and my heart sank. I was afraid my dad was going to be stuck at PKB. Bondo could see the gloom on my face and explained that he just had to fly 3 touch-and-goes, with complete stops, of course, and then we could leave for Parkersburg. He asked his instructor if it would be okay if I came along, which was approved. This meant 3 more takeoffs and landings for me, so I was even more thrilled. Bondo and I climbed into a gleaming green and white Cessna 172. He familiarized me with the cockpit and emergency procedures, and we got going. Hard to believe looking back on it, but this was only the 2nd time I had ever flown GA, and the 1st time I was in a 172. Bondo regained his night currency and explained all that was going on to me. He was a good teacher and really helped me gain an understanding of what his responsibilities were as PIC. We made our final takeoff from runway 25, turned east, and headed to Parkersburg. We were in uncontrolled airspace for most of the flight and flew pretty much due east toward the Ohio River, then headed north toward PKB. It was a smooth and uneventful flight, but for me it was fabulous. I was flying, which by itself was amazing. But I was on my way to pick up my dad, who was looking forward to a weekend together filled with music, beer, and food. Now, although music, beer, and food, and not necessarily in that order, were things my dad and I both shared a passion for, I was also excited as I was going to surprise him with an airplane pickup. For lack of a better term, airplane geekery was another passion we shared, but had never experienced in a small plane together. We landed on runway 10 in Parkersburg and secured the airplane by the FBO, which was right next to the commercial terminal. Based on the times, Bondo and I were able to walk across the tarmac and right into the terminal from the outside, where we waited for my dad's flight to come in. It was not a long wait. An Allegheny BAC-111 taxied to the terminal zone, lowered its air stairs, and started to unload passengers. Bondo and I were able to walk right up to the stairway and meet my dad at the bottom. I made introductions, picked my dad's bag off the cart, and we headed across the tarmac. Now at this point, Lou still didn't know we were flying. He pulled a cigar out of his pocket and was ready to start his weekend with a smoke. I was still trying to keep the flight a secret and was heartbroken when I had to stop him from unwrapping the cigar and saying that Bondo didn't allow smoking in his truck. When we didn't turn toward the parking lot, my dad started to get curious and could tell that something was up. At this point, we were about 20 feet from the 172, and I pointed to it and said we were headed to Athens by air. I wish you could have seen the smile on my dad's face. It was a Victor McLaughlin smile, so bright that it could have lit the whole runway. It had been at least 25 years since Lou was in a single-engine aircraft, and he was obviously delighted. With his bag in hand, I climbed into the back seat so my dad could have the right-hand seat experience. We buckled in and soon took off from runway 28 and headed toward UNI. Although I was in the back, the return flight to Athens was even better than the outbound, as I was sharing it with the man who would help make me the airplane geek I didn't even know I was at the time. The flight was over far too soon, and we all climbed into the front seat of Bondo's pickup and headed to town. It was a whirlwind dad's weekend. Lou and I went to see one of our favorite bluegrass bands, the New Vinton County Frogwompers, marching, singing, strumming, and a plucking society. We tried new beers and ate some great Mexican food. I have no idea how I got him back to the airport on Sunday. It's been too many beers and too many years to recall. But the flight to Athens? Well, my dad and I never forgot it. For the airplane geeks in Portland, this is your main man, Micah.
Well, thanks, Micah. Another great story from Micah. I love these kinds of experiences. You know, it's amazing how just a little touch of aviation can just enrich your life so much. It's just wonderful.
It's so true. This just warms my heart.
I know. Now, again, we love listener recordings. We have a couple others that we'll hold for another episode. We have one specifically from Tony that we're looking forward to playing for you. We'll try to play that next week. As always, we really invite, as I say, listeners to you all to send in recordings, anything about, well, anything related to aviation, an experience you had, the person that influenced you, anything of that sort. And we love to receive them. We love to share them with everyone. Speaking of sharing, one thing that I wanted to do, I kind of do this every year, and it's sort of an unsolicited plug. You'll recall that we've had Igor Sikorsky III on two episodes, as I recall. And Igor runs a North Maine Woods sportsman camp. It's called the Bradford Camps. It's just an idyllic sort of location. It's on a lake. No one else is on the lake. There's really only two ways you can get there. You can arrive by some sort of float plane service, or you can drive if you're not shy about spending, well, what could be 3 or 4 hours on logging roads, dirt logging roads to get there. But one thing he does each year is run what he calls the Sikorsky Weekend. And what he does is he has a huge collection of historic memorabilia, books, videos, artifacts from the Sikorsky family. And he does lectures, seminars that are given by Igor Sikorsky's son or his grandson, Igor Sikorsky III, and other members of the family from time to time. And they often will have a guest speaker as well. David, wasn't Jamie Dodson a guest speaker a year or two ago?
Yeah, actually, he was talking about the Sikorsky flying boats.
Yeah. So this is a great weekend. It's a three-day weekend. You can enjoy the scenery, have a chance to spend some time with Igor Sikorsky III, who was quite a historian himself. You can find all that at bradfordcamps.com. We'll put a link to that in the show notes, of course. Price is pretty reasonable. It's just a wonderful, wonderful way to spend 3 days in the North Maine woods. My wife and I did that some years ago, and we look forward to doing it again. All right, guys. Well, I think that's about it for this episode of the Airplane Geeks podcast. We want to.
No!
I know
no!
It's hard to. Well, Binet, tell us quickly. What are some of the recent things going on in your world? Anything exciting?
Well, I do want to say that I took the Princess of Planes on a surprise trip to Europe for Christmas.
Nice.
We flew Delta, and the folks at Delta were just absolutely wonderful. Both flights were great, and we had a grand time. And my daughter was very kind. She brought candies to all the flight attendants, so that made her very popular on the flights. We waited until they had finished all the meal services and everything, but it was just really great. Great trip. Take your kids traveling when you can, even if you can't go far, just take them somewhere.
It's a great experience. Yeah,
it is.
All right. But hey, tell our listeners where they can find you online, all the great places to follow you.
Well, I'm on Twitter at AvQueenBenet, B-E-N-E-T. I am also at the aviationqueen.com blog. And I also run the Airways News Twitter account, which is Airways News. And we have a Facebook page. And I am on Google Plus, you guys.
Yay.
Me and the other three people.
You keep saying that.
But Binet Wilson.
Two of which are on the show.
Right.
Exactly. Yeah. So I always love hearing from people. And if you're out and about, come by and say hi.
Very good. Actually, the Airplane Geeks Google Plus community, let me see how many members we have as this thing loads up, but it's reasonably active. We have, let's see, as of this moment, 1,350 members of the Google Plus Airplane Geeks community. So if you haven't checked that out, we invite you to do just that.
Oh, wonderful.
Yeah, it's great. We want to thank our guest, especially Dennis Hazel. He's the manager of customer service with the Metropolitan Washington Airports Authority. We'll have links to all of that in the show notes. David Vanderhoof, want to thank you for soldiering on and lasting the entire. You did last the entire episode, didn't you?
Yeah, I did. I'm still here. Surprise, surprise.
All right, great. And we'll look forward to having Brian and Rob on again next episode. Hopefully their schedules will allow it. You can find out more about us and our contributors at airplanegeeks.net. That's kind of a hub, if you will, or a launching point for Airplane Geeks, the Jetwine blog, the UAV Digest that David and I do, that podcast. Also, David's What Just Flew By blog, the Plane Crazy Down Under, and Aviation Extended podcast.
We might need to add the Av Queen blog to that, since she is a weekly part of the show.
I think we should. So, Binet, tootle over to airplanegeeks.net, take a look, and send us, if you'd like, send us the corresponding information for Aviation Queen. We'll make sure to put that in there as well.
I will do that, only if you promise to call me 20 minutes in advance next time.
Instead of 15. All right, it's a deal. Opening and closing music is by Brother Love. Find him at brotherloverocks.com. So join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast.
Oh, no, no, no. She's live. She's got to do it. Come on, Binet, you know it.
And if you want to call the Airplane Geeks, dial 321-361.
3-6-1.
It's been a long time, right?
Okay. And if you want to call the Airplane Geeks, call 361-GEEKS-01.
Thank you, Binet. Bye, everybody.
Thanks
Goodbye.
For listening.
Bye. Thank you.
Hot as hell. Beautiful and low.
You're drinking on the call, really?
I'm drinking.
Yeah. How do you think we do this every week, Binet?
Of the universe, I tell you, it was wonderful.
Bloody. Oh, it's only the Melbourne cricket ground. I mean, the MCG. Jeez, come on, man.
Come on, man. I had to wear a tie.
Oh, my God.
It was hell.
It must have been just like going back to England. Oh, and here we are, the members area. Yes, I say what.
All I can tell you is that...
So when my phone goes off like that...
Yeah, I can hear that.
That's my mother-in-law.
Does that mean you need to get that?
No, I'm going to ignore it.